Okay, brethren, well, good morning once again to those of you in the United States of America, and good afternoon to those of you here in England. It's actually a superb and beautiful, gorgeous day today in England. Temperature must be in the high 60s, which is very warm for us. Blue skies, sunshine, the fields and the trees are green, the flowers are out. It is absolutely a fantastically beautiful day. And a good day to keep God's Sabbath. We're continuing our Bible study and reading of the book of Exodus. And last week, we had to stop really in the middle of one particular episode. And the portion of Exodus we are now in are the events that took place at that very first feast of Pentecost. And what had happened, you may recollect, in chapter 19 of Exodus, God had proposed the Old Covenant, this special invitation to Israel to be his wife. And he had said, you know, look, Israel, if you will obey my voice, if you will keep my covenant, this Old Covenant as we now call it, then I'll make you a special people, a kingdom of priests, my own peculiar treasure. And that was the invitation given to ancient Israel. And the people, of course, said, Amen, so be it, brother, yes, we will. And so we got underway looking at the terms of this particular covenant. In chapter 20, an extremely well-known chapter, we come to the Ten Commandments, which God himself spoke to the millions of Israelites as they assembled in front of Mount Sinai. And then the people, of course, were a bit frightened of this supreme being. They never actually did trust Jehovah God. They always suspected him of trying to destroy them, as we find out in many other places. So ultimately they asked Moses to intervene. And so God stopped speaking after he gave the Ten Commandments. And then in chapter 21, which we began last week, we were looking at, as it says in verse 1 of chapter 21, now these are the judgments which you, Moses, shall set before them. And so in chapters 21 and 22 and 23, which we'll continue reading today, we have these judgments, these regulations. And it's worth remembering as we begin that there is more than one set of laws in the Bible. Some Protestant teachers try to lump everything together as just being one law. And then they find a scripture that implies that perhaps some law is done away, and they try to do away with all the laws. Well, there is the Ten Commandments law, which is holy and just and good and eternal. Then there are these laws here, the ones we go through in a moment or two, the regulations or judgments. And we'll remember that God was creating here a kingdom of which he would be the king. It was the nation of Israel. It was a civil society. There were civil judgments and regulations and civil laws as to how the nation should conduct itself. Just as today, there are many civil laws and statutes in Texas and Tennessee and California, federal laws across the USA. There are laws in England that are similar but occasionally different laws in Scotland and across Europe. So these were the civil laws given to Moses to pass on to the Israelites. On top of that, there were the sacrificial laws, the laws that you applied as to how you would sacrifice, what you would sacrifice, when you would sacrifice, and so on. So now we're looking closely at the civil judgments that applied to Israel as God's nation. We got as far last week as, I believe, verse 17. We've been talking there about several regulations for which the death penalty was to be carried out. For example, acts of murder. Now picking up the story, I think we got as far as verse 17. He who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. So as far as God is concerned, when you're running a nation and you want to ensure the highest standards of public conduct, you cannot have individuals who treat their parents very badly. The term curses his father or mother can be translated as treat with contempt. Now, we know, for example, that children are often cheeky to their parents. It's even possible that you or I in our lives may have been somewhat disrespectful to our mums and dads. That's obviously not exactly good, but that's not exactly either the death penalty. We're looking here about somebody who curses, who treats with utter contempt and utter disrespect, treats like dirt his mother or his father. Now those people, if they are as extreme as that, God says, well, they shall surely be put to death. Continuing on, verse 18. If men contend, well, I'll tell you, this verse, this next couple of verses is quite intriguing. It looks fairly innocent on the surface when you read them, but I discovered in reading around this particular chapter that these next two verses, verse 18, sorry. If men contend with each other, and one strikes the other with a stone, or with his fist, and he does not die, but is confined to his bed, if he rises again and walks about outside with his staff, then he who struck him shall be acquitted. He shall only pay for the loss of his time and shall provide for him to be thoroughly healed. So these gentlemen are engaged in some sort of argument. It turns to blows, to fisticuffs. If the one recovers, then the individual who harmed him has got to, in a sense, provide financially for him. He has to compensate him. And of course, that's not dissimilar to many of the laws that we have today. If you injure somebody, perhaps you're driving your car carelessly, you injure another person, then the law may hold you responsible for that person's loss of income while they're off work, and may hold you responsible for actually paying for that person's treatment. So not dissimilar, way back here, 1400 odd BC. And if a man beats his servant or his maidservant with a rod so that he dies under his hand, he shall surely be punished. Quite right too. But remember that in these days, when there were slaves, probably many countries treated slaves extremely badly, and killing a slave was deemed to be nothing. Slaves had no value. So these regulations here were designed to improve the lot of the slaves. Notwithstanding, if he remains alive a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his property. Now, this was a verse I was jumping ahead to, verse 22, and I want to read that before I read it in the New King James Version, which is a translation I actually use. I want to read it in a couple of other translations first, because it turns out rather surprisingly that this rather nondescript verse 22 in Exodus chapter 21 is actually a hotbed of dispute among people over the issue of abortion, of all things. And the reason is as follows. If we read this verse in the King James Version, which perhaps a number of you are doing, it reads as follows. If men strive and hurt a woman with child, you know, a pregnant lady, so that her fruit depart from her, and yet no mischief follow, he shall be surely punished, according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. Now that appears to say that if these men are fighting and a pregnant lady is injured and she loses her baby, but she isn't any more injured herself than that, Well, there'll be a fine levied upon the individual who caused the harm. And the husband will help to determine the amount of that fine, and the judges will consider whether it's fair or not. But apparently, it would seem that the baby is of no value, because, you know, only if the lady is injured is there any punishment. If the child is dead, then the child is no value. And so the argument goes, well, that demonstrates that a child in the womb is not yet a person. Because here's God's laws, and it shows that the child being lost itself has of no value. Only if the woman is injured is there any punishment or penalty. The child is not recognized by God as an individual being, and hence abortion is not, in that sense, morally wrong. That's how the argument goes. If I read out of the Good News Bible, the same verse, this is what it says. If some men are fighting and hurt a pregnant woman so that she loses her child, but she's not injured in any other way, the one who hurt her is to be fined whatever amount the woman's husband demands, subject to the approval of the judges. But if the woman herself is injured, the punishment shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, and so on. So as far as some translations of the Bible are concerned, it frankly doesn't matter if the unborn child is killed, because, as the argument goes, the baby has no value, not yet being born. And to many people who claim to be sort of pro-choice, which means for abortion, then that is good news. So strangely enough, this verse in the Bible, rather obscure, does feature in a number of current emotional and strong arguments. But let's carry on and read it now in the New King James Version. And this is similar to many other modern translations, which appear to be a little bit more accurate. Verse 22, if men fight and hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely. Now, there's no indication here that the baby is dead. It's just that she gives birth somewhat earlier than a normal term. Yet no lasting harm follows to mother or baby. He shall surely be punished accordingly as the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if any lasting harm follows to mother or baby, I'm putting that in there, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. In other words, the punishment must sort of fit the crime. If it's a serious injury, there must be a serious penalty. If it's a minor injury, a more minor penalty. And so the more correct translations, such as the New King James Version, I believe the New American Standard Bible and similar, they make it fairly plain that if the baby is born unharmed, there will still be some financial consequences to the parents because the baby's arrived earlier. There may be extra expenses in treating that child and so on. And so those extra expenses must be levied against the person that caused the harm. But if the child is injured, or shall we say even dies, then there is life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. So rather than saying that the baby has no value, a proper translation of this verse shows that it's the same rule for the mother and for the little baby. Either being injured brings punishment upon the one that caused the injury. So I just thought that was rather interesting that, you know, I don't often go to Exodus 21 or 2 or 3. These civil judgments don't quite have the same relevance to us in our modern society, and yet here's a rather odd verse being battled over by the abortionists and anti-abortionist people. Carrying on, verse 26. And if a man strike the eye of his servant or the eye of his maidservant and destroys it, he shall let him go free for the sake of his eye. And if he knocks out his servant's tooth or his maidservant's tooth, he shall let him go free for the sake of his tooth. Now, I don't know for sure, but I suspect that in ancient Egypt, Babylon, Assyria, wherever, that any master that injured his slave, that was just tough cookies on the slave. He went around with one eye or several teeth missing because he was the property of his master. But the way that God would have designed this system for carnal people, and they were carnal people, they did not have God's Holy Spirit. They were not converted. God is to give rules and regulations that would work in a carnal civil society. And God said, look, you injure a slave, he goes free. Now, what would that do? It probably meant, since slaves were very valuable, were economically important, that the vast majority of masters would be very careful not to mistreat a slave, because they would know, if I hit that slave and even knock one of his teeth out, I've lost him. He can walk out. The law stands back of him. He's got, if you like, the rights of a slave. And so therefore, I better be quite careful in how I deal with my slaves physically, because I don't want to lose a valuable employee, which in a sense they were, by being a bit foolish about how I conduct myself. Carrying on now in verse 28, we get to some more regulations about what happens if one of your cattle causes problems. If an ox gores a man or a woman to death, then the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten. But the owner of the ox shall be acquitted. You don't hold the guy guilty if this ox did something that was unsuspected, unexpected. It was out of the blue. But if the ox tended to thrust with its horns in times past, and it has been made known to his owner, and he has not kept it confined, so that it has killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner also shall be put to death. That's quite serious. And it's not dissimilar, in a sense, to some of the laws even over here in England. If you have perhaps a pet dog, and that dog's normally quite docile and causes no trouble, but one day takes a turn, dashes into the road, chases a car, and causes an accident with injury, loss of life, it's almost certain that the animal's owner would not be found guilty because the dog did something that was really unforeseen. On the other hand, in British law today, English law today, if your dog has a habit of running out into the road and causing near accidents, and one day causes an accident, and you were very well aware of that and did not take steps to keep your dog under complete control, you will be held liable. And so even English law today has the same principles as ancient Israelite law, and perhaps no great surprise since we happen to be descended from them. Verse 30, if it is imposed on him a sum of money, then he shall pay to redeem his life whatever is imposed on him. Verse 31, whether it has gored a son or gored a daughter, according to this judgment it shall be done to him. If the ox gores a manservant or a maidservant, he shall give to their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. Verse 33, there are some rules now about property. And if a man opens a pit, you know, digs a pit and a hole in the ground, or if a man digs a pit and does not cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make it good. He shall give money to their owner, but the dead beast shall be his. And this is a fair comment. You know, if you're a contractor and you know, you're building a road and you leave perhaps an excavation that's not properly protected, not properly covered, and along comes somebody in their little jeep or their wagon, or you know, in those days it would be an ox or an ass or a donkey, today it would be your Chevrolet, whatever, and it goes tumbling into the hole, then there should be a certain recovery rights, and that's what God was dealing with. Verse 35, and if one man's ox hurts another's, so this would be, I guess, two oxen having a bit of a fight, so that it dies, Then they shall sell the live ox and divide the money from it, and the dead ox also they shall divide. So it's entirely fair, both oxes. But verse 36, if it was known that the ox tended to thrust in time past, and its owner has not kept it confined, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead beast shall be his own. So, you know, God was setting in motion here civil judgments, civil regulations that are applied in a very practical sense. And there's always the possibility that many of these examples here had been brought by the people already to Moses. And so God was giving Moses some really very concrete, definite examples of how to apply his overall law of looking out for your neighbor and showing love to your neighbor. And things could happen by accident, they could happen by carelessness, they could happen deliberately. And here were the principles that could be applied to govern what was always going to be a rather difficult carnal nation. Chapter 22. Now we're getting to theft of property. If a man steals an ox or a sheep, or today steals your Cadillac, and slaughters it or sells it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. And I guess, you know, if he stole your Cadillac, perhaps 4 times the value, which might cause people to stop and think twice. And by the way, you don't find, going through these verses, much reference to putting people in prison. In fact, I don't think there's any references here to people going into prison for their offenses. The death penalty is certainly there, and there's many rules about compensation and how much people should be compensated, you know, by a thief or by a person who's been guilty of violence. But it doesn't look in God's way of doing things that prison has a very high profile. I think, as we said last week, you know, prisons, if you think about them, they're obviously not nice places. And many people go to prison and just learn more about how to be a criminal. You can send young 17, 18-year-old, rather foolish children into prisons, and they come out 5 years later, and they're hardened criminals. They've learned many more ways to be violent, to steal, to hotwire cars, to take drugs. They probably learned also about homosexuality and all sorts of nasty things. So prisons in any way are not at all useful in society. And God's ways, no doubt, had they ever been applied, would be far better. Verse 2. If the thief is found breaking in, and he is struck so that he dies, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. The implication is this would be at night time when it's dark, and you find this person breaking in, and it's all a bit difficult, and in the struggle, in the fight, you kill this person. You're not guilty. Verse 3. If the sun has risen on him, in other words, you can see him now, and it's more obvious that he's perhaps not out for violence, but just trying to rustle some of your cattle, there shall be guilt for his bloodshed. He should make full restitution. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. So if he's sold on the property, it's not there, okay, he himself can be sold into employment, and his wages, if you like, will be used to offset what he's stolen. Verse 4, if the theft is certainly found alive in his hand, whether it is an ox or donkey or sheep or whatever, he shall restore double. So the rules are a bit different. You know, if he'd sold on your animal and it was lost, he had to replace 4 or 5 times. If he still had it, he had to return it plus 100% markup, you know, double. Verse 5, if a man causes a field or vineyard to be grazed and lets loose his animal and it feeds in another man's field, that's like, I guess, trespass, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and the best of his own vineyard. And of course, that happens today. You know, cattle break out of their own area, wander into somebody else's, you know, luscious field, munch away all the best of the turnips and potatoes and things. And it's like, well, hang on a moment. What do you do in that situation? Well, God gave Moses the answer. Verse 6, if fire breaks out and catches in thorns. So here might be somebody perhaps tidying up some debris, and they build a bonfire, and the bonfire gets out of control, and the fire rages into neighboring fields and burns up just at harvest time the very finest of their crops. What do you do? Verse 6, the fire breaks out and catches in thorns, so that stacked grain, standing grain, or the field is consumed. He who kindled the fire shall surely make restitution. And that's still the case, at least in English law. If you light a fire and you allow it to spread carelessly to neighboring property, you'll be held legally liable. Verse 7, we're getting here now to giving goods into somebody's custody or control, or entrusting goods to somebody. Could be on a personal level, could be on a commercial level. If a man delivers to his neighbor money or articles to keep, and it is stolen out of the man's house, if the thief is found, he shall pay double. If the thief is not found, then the master of the house shall be brought to the judges to see whether he has put his hand into his neighbor's goods. There's no evidence of a thief here, and no evidence of another third-party criminal, but the goods are missing. Was it a genuine crook? Or did it turn out perhaps that the man himself has been guilty of, selling on his neighbor's goods? For any kind of trespass, whether it concerns an ox, or a donkey, or a sheep, or clothing, or for any kind of lost thing which another claims to be his, it could be jewelry, perhaps a watch that you gave to a jewelry store to repair for you. It could be anything that has been entrusted to somebody else. The cause of both parties shall come before the judges, and whomever the judges condemn shall pay double to his neighbor, because either party, of course, could be guilty here of lying. If a man delivers to his neighbor a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any beast to keep, and it dies, is hurt, or driven away, no one seeing it, no evidence, then an oath of the eternal shall be between them both, that he has not put his hand into his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it shall accept that, and he shall not make it good. But if, in fact, it is stolen from him, he shall make restitution to the owner of it. If it is torn in pieces by an animal, then he shall bring it as evidence, and he shall not make good what was torn. If it is done by some wild animal, that's just an accident, just life, sorry, no compensation there. And if a man borrows anything from his neighbor, and it becomes injured or dies, the owner of it not being with it, he shall surely make it good. But if the owner was with it, he shall not make it good. If it was hired, it came for its hire. So if the owner was there, really, he's responsible for its safety. So that finishes the look at the civil laws regarding property. The heading in my Bible now says the next portion is about proper conduct. And it starts off verse 16. We'd make quite a change to modern-day society if this was practiced. And if a man entices a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, he shall surely pay the bride price for her to be his wife. So here's one assumes perhaps a young man who seduces, entices a young virgin girl who is not betrothed. She's not engaged to be married. He shall take her as his wife. That's basically what the instruction is here. Verse 17, if her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money according to the bride price of virgins. So he still has to pay money to the father. If the father says, no, I'm not giving her to you in marriage, you are an absolute waste of space. You are a scoundrel, a ragamuffin, and a no good. She's not going to be your wife, Sonny Boy. Nonetheless, Sonny Boy has to cough up some money. And in many cases, Sonny Boy ends up married. So it's quite likely, I suspect, that if in today's age young men realize that if they decided to bed a young lady, they may end up married for the next 50 or more years, it might slow down some of their activity. What would be the case if the young lady was betrothed? What if she was actually engaged to another man. Well, we can find that if we keep our finger here, but turn briefly to Deuteronomy chapter 22. Deuteronomy chapter 22. And we'll start in verse 23. If a young woman who is a virgin is betrothed to a husband, so this is a bit of a different situation. This young lady is engaged to be married. And as far as the custom of that day was concerned, if you were engaged or betrothed, you were essentially already, at least in God's eyes, married, because the man is called here her husband. And a man finds her in the city and lies with her. Okay, so this time the young man, if we assume he's a young man, entices, seduces this young lady who is engaged. Then verse 24, you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death with stones. The young woman, because she did not cry out in the city, and the man, because he humbled his neighbor's wife. So you shall put away the evil person from among you. So already, even though just engaged, they were deemed to be husband and wife. And so this other man had essentially, gone to bed with another man's wife. So both would be put to death, because the assumption is both parties, the young woman and young man, were happy to conduct this affair. Verse 25, but if a man finds a betrothed young woman in the countryside, where there's obviously not many people around to hear what's going on, and the man forces her and lies with her, then only the man who lay with her shall die. Now he's dying this time because this young girl is betrothed. She is essentially already, in God's eyes, the wife of her future husband. But you shall do nothing to the young woman. There is in the young woman no sin worthy of death, for just as when a man rises against his neighbor and kills him, even so is this matter. For he found her in the countryside, and the betrothed young woman cried out, that's the assumption, but there's no one to save her. So she's given the benefit of the doubt that she had tried to attract attention, but nobody's there to rescue her. And then carrying on verse 28, if a man finds a young woman who is a virgin, who is not betrothed, is what we read earlier, and he, it says, seizes her in my version, I think seduces is the better translation, and lies with her, and they are found out, then the man who lay with her shall give to the young woman's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife, because he has humbled her. He shall not be permitted to divorce her all his days. So that's rather different to the law today, rather different to the practice we find in San Antonio and London and Birmingham and Chicago and so on. The laws today are, well, there's no comparison, is there? Today almost anything goes, and today, you know, young men and women might have 5 or 10 or 20 or 30 or more partners before they eventually settle down in marriage, if at all. Even when married, faithfulness isn't necessarily, very strong. As far as God's concerned, God has a very high view of faithfulness. God is faithful to his people. He expects his people to be faithful to him. He expects husbands to be faithful to their wives, and vice versa. And even people who get betrothed, in a sense, God's looking for faithfulness there. Not sort of an easy-come, easy-go, casual nature like today. Some of the film stars that you see today in the magazines and newspapers, Lopez, J-Lo, and people like that, they have 2 or 3 husbands and wives and so on. And really today it's all very, very casual. Carrying on verse 18. You shall not permit a sorceress to live. That certainly doesn't apply today. Today are sorceresses and wizards and horoscope writers and similar are celebrities. There's any number of TV programs you can look at where the star performer happens to be some chap that reckons he can tell your future. And he can tell from the fact that Pluto is now rising in Aquarius and so on, what's going to happen in your love life later in the week. And rather than putting to death sorceresses and sorcerers and so on, nowadays they get lots of money. And there are many people who the first thing they do when they pick up a newspaper is turn to their daily horoscope to find out what the sorcerer or sorceress has got to say about that day. Will I be lucky in love today? Will I be lucky in my finances today? And really, you know, God has no tolerance at all for people who meddle in the occult and so on. We take it rather more casually than God does. We can laugh and smile at some of these guys who are sometimes just, of course, they're just con men on occasions, making money out of people's simple trust in them. But other times there are individuals who are rather close to the occult world who do meddle with demons and demonic forces. I think there was one actress some years back, you may recollect Shirley MacLaine. She was a fairly famous actress 20 or so years ago. More just strange to me, she's Warren Beatty's sister. But Shirley MacLaine heavily went into spiritism and even wrote a book entitled, you know, Out on a, or was it Out on a Limb? If you want to reach the fruit, you've got to go out on a limb. And you know, she came to the conclusion that you will never die. Because really all that happens is that your body ends this particular existence and you just move on into another existence. And she heard voices speaking to her saying that, you know, she will not surely die, which is always intriguing. It sounds very much like the Garden of Eden, where the devil said, "Ye shall not surely die." In this case, the voice told her, "Surely you will not die." And she was heavily involved with the occult world. And, you know, there are things that come from the occult world that can sometimes mystify and impress people. I know some years ago, there were certain ladies who seemed to be often females who predicted, for example, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And you, whoa, there must be something in this because they could predict a future event. They must be in touch with the spirit realm. Well, yes, indeed they are. But, of course, the catch is that which part of the spirit realm? You know, if somebody is planning an event, like, say, planning to assassinate President Kennedy, or somebody's planning, shall we say, the World Trade Center attack on September the 11th, then if they're talking to each other on the phones or perhaps emailing each other and making these plans about, you know, next Wednesday at this time we will do that, then often there are demons listening in to such conversations. Demons are aware of the plans. Demons may even be involved in actually putting these ideas into the minds of the Osama bin Ladens and so on. And so it's no problem for the demons who know of the plans, which of course might fail, but very often will actually come to pass. Those demons can easily go to a sorceress or a sorcerer and just whisper in the night, you know, next Tuesday, next Wednesday, such and such is going to happen at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Along comes our, you know, our horoscope writer, whatever, and makes a statement. And lo and behold, it comes to pass. And suddenly the guy is thought to have, you know, great insight, great ability to predict the future. You know, all that's happening is he's being given inside information by demons who are present when the plans are being hatched. But God will not tolerate such. And it says there, you shall not permit a sorceress to live. Nowadays, we permit them to make millions of dollars from being on TV. Verse 19. Whoever lies with the beast shall surely be put to death. Again, that happens today. He who sacrifices to any god except to the eternal only, he shall be utterly destroyed. You know, nowadays, a big thing in our society is toleration. You've got to be tolerant of other people. Now, to an extent, of course, it is good to be tolerant of people's weaknesses, to be patient. We all make mistakes. We all let down and we want people to be patient with us. That's fine. Tolerating some of those weaknesses that we're all, you know, prey to is a good idea. But not tolerating things which are black and white sin, which are utterly condemned by God. To tolerate these things is not good in God's sight. Today, if you were to stand up in public and perhaps comment that homosexuality is not really an ideal way to live and has got many problems attached to it, you'd be shouted down. You might even be, at least in England, you might be arrested and charged with some sort of hate crime. So things have changed a lot nowadays, and you have to tolerate and allow for almost every type of weird behavior. If you try and step against it, you know, you're the one who is the peculiar one. You're the minority. You're the odd one out. You're the one who'll be in trouble. Verse 21, you shall not mistreat a stranger nor oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. It would be easy to look down on somebody who is not a native of your state or county or town. And God says, don't do that. There was a time, Israel, when you were slaves, when you were foreigners. You know what it's like. You've been there. Don't try and get uppity in your turn and look down on other people. Don't do it. You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. You know, show love to your neighbor. If you afflict them in any way and they cry at all to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath will become hot, and I will kill you with the sword. Your wives shall be widows and your children fatherless. So be careful, says God. If you lend money to any of my people who are poor among you, you shall not be like a money lender to him. You shall not charge him interest. This is if you're lending money to a poor person to help them out. You can't then saddle them with some gigantic, you know, compound interest debt, you know, 50% a day or per hour or part thereof. You can't suddenly make the poor desperately poorer. If you're lending money to a poor person, do it for the right reasons, to help them, not to make them, you know, even more indebted than when they started. It's different if you're lending money commercially to a business concern. That's fair enough. If you're investing in a business, you want some extra bank. That's not a problem. This is if it's a poor person. If you ever take your neighbor's garment as a pledge, that's this poor person, I assume, you shall return it to him before the sun goes down, the very same day. For that is his only covering. It is his garment for his skin. What will he sleep in? Because I think for the very poor, you know, their garment, their outer clothing, was what literally they slept in overnight. They just sort of lay down in the back of some old room somewhere, huddled up, and pulled their garment around their, you know, their head and shoulders and went to sleep. So if you took that as a pledge and didn't return it, you know, they'd almost freeze through the night. And so God says, look, you look after the poor people. Don't treat them badly. Don't take advantage of them. Don't exploit them. And it will be that when he cries to me, I will hear, for I am gracious. You shall not revile God, nor curse a ruler of your people. You shall not delay to offer the first of your ripe produce and your juices. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. Likewise, you shall do with your oxen and your sheep. It shall be with its mother 7 days. On the eighth day you shall give it to me. And you shall be holy men to me. You shall not eat any meat which is torn by beasts in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs. Continuing on, chapter 23. More judgments, more rules and regulations. You shall not circulate a false report. That would be something not dissimilar to gossip. If you know a story that's not true, then God says, stop it. Don't pick up the phone and pass on a story that's not true. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You know, God likes truth, not lying and exaggerating and people being devious and so on. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil. And there is always a danger in following any crowd, no matter what they're up to, because many crowds do turn nasty. There's a sort of strange crowd psychology at times. And we have to be careful when we're with the large crowds not to get pulled along by the atmosphere and end up doing things we'd regret later. Don't follow a crowd to do evil. There's a scripture in 1 Corinthians that says that bad company corrupts good manners. if you keep bad company, if you go to the crowd, either on an occasion or regularly, then if it's bad company, it will eventually, most of the time, it will corrupt us. But we're rather careful about the company we keep. Nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. It doesn't matter if there's 99 of them going to tell a lie in court, and you're the odd one out. As far as God's concerned, you better tell the truth. You shall not show partiality to a poor man in his dispute. It doesn't matter if he's poor. That doesn't mean you sort of suddenly bend the rules to help him out because he's poor. You know, truth is truth. What is right is right. What is honest is honest. God doesn't want you being partial to a rich person, nor does he want us being partial to a poor person. Let's do what is right, irrespective of the other person. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall surely bring it back to him again. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, and you would refrain from helping it, you shall surely help him with it. You know, you're even going to treat your enemy with respect, as far as God's concerned. Love thy neighbor as thyself. You shall not pervert the judgment of your poor in his dispute. Keep yourself far from a false matter. Do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not justify the wicked. And you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the discerning and perverts the words of the righteous. Also, you shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. And obviously the judges themselves, reading these instructions here, would be well aware that, woo, I think God's laying it on us here that when we make these judgments using these regulations and the wisdom that God gives us, we've got to be very sure that we are honest, do not take bribes, do not turn to the left hand or to the right hand. And of course, that's what God's looking for in all of us. God wants us to be scrupulously honest with him and each other. Verse 10, we get now to the so-called sabbatical year. "6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its produce. But the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat," obviously in that year. "And what they leave, the beasts of the field may eat. In like manner you shall do with your vineyard and your olive grove." So for 6 years you could work your land, but the seventh year the land ceased from its labors and had a jolly, well-earned rest. And in that seventh year, poor people could go into the field and find what was there, and even the animals could pick around and dig out what they fancied. You might think, well, hang on a second, I mean, you know, 6 years I can labor and work and so on, but I'll probably starve in the seventh year because there'll be no harvest for me. And that's not a very good idea. What about the year after that? You know, I can't even work in the seventh year, so the next year there won't be much around, will there? Because I won't have been digging and planting and, oh my, surely this is going to economically ruin me as a farmer. It can't possibly work, can it? And of course, in a sort of a... in a sense, if there's no God, then it won't work very well. But this was a method that God used, in a sense, to try to drive his people to trust him. Because to obey this law required a considerable amount of faith that God would make it work. And also would remind people that, actually, God is the landowner. He owns the earth. He allows us to employ the earth and to use it. But really, God is the owner, and farmers and so on are tenants. And if the boss says, leave the land every seventh year, I guess, if we believe the master, if we believe the owner of the land, then we better do that. And had they done it, of course, God would have blessed them. If you keep your finger there and turn briefly to Leviticus chapter 25, we can see the answer. This does not look practical, does it? Leviticus chapter 25, starting in verse 20. "And if you say, what shall we eat in the seventh year, since we shall not sow, nor gather in our produce. Then I will command my blessing on you in the sixth year, and it will bring forth produce enough for 3 years. So God would have had a hand when he saw them obeying his commandments. The God who gives us the air and the rain in due season and the sunshine, and the God who can keep the insects and things away, would have ensured that the crop would have produced bountifully in the sixth year, giving them enough food for 3 years, more abundance than otherwise. So God's able to make, you know, all things work together for good to those who love him. But of course, I think for the most part, people didn't do this. I know that at Ambassador College in Brickett Wood, that for some years they did try on the land and the farm there to follow the sabbatical law and to use the land for 6 years at a time and leave it on the seventh year in accordance with Scripture, trying to demonstrate that in the real world you could actually do it. I've got to say I'm not actually sure what the outcome of that was. I never did read the outcome of that, but certainly I know they were trying to put into practice the sabbatical law. I suspect it's something that probably works more on a national level than on a sort of a personal level. Verse 12, 6 days you shall do your work, and on the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your maidservant and the stranger may be refreshed. And in all that I have said to you, be circumspect, and make no mention of the name of other gods, nor let it be heard from your mouth. Verse 14, we get now to some instructions about the three holy day seasons. 3 times you shall keep a feast to me in the year. I think we're quite familiar with these verses. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread, brackets, you shall eat unleavened bread 7 days, as I commanded you, at the time appointed in the month of Abib, for in it you came out of Egypt. None shall appear before me empty. And so we know that we should bring an offering at these 3 occasions. Verse 16, and, in addition, the feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labors which you have sown in the field. And that would be Pentecost, the day of the first fruits. And the third season, the feast of ingathering, which we normally call tabernacles, which is at the end of the year. That's the end of the agricultural year, when you've gathered in the fruit of your labors from the field. 3 times, or 3 seasons, or 3 occasions in the year, all your males shall appear before the Lord God. Verse 18, you shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, nor shall the fat of my sacrifice remain until morning. That would be an instruction, I imagine, about the Passover, which you must eat with unleavened bread, and must not allow to remain until morning time. Verse 19, the first of the first fruits of your land you shall bring into the house of the Eternal your God, which I imagine is referring to the second season, Pentecost, which is of course first fruits. And then this rather strange sort of portion of the verse here, you shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk, which seems rather strange, just appearing in the middle of the chapter. But if it's referring to harvest time, at ingathering, then there does appear to have been a sort of practice of the pagan religions, which they carried out at harvest time in the autumn, of literally boiling a young goat in the milk of his mother. So the goat would give birth, and in the milk produced, they would actually boil the young goat, and then eat it, of course, as a sacrifice, and sprinkle the, I believe, the milk over the crops as well. So that was a sort of harvest time, fall, autumn type practice carried out by many of the pagan nations. God saying, don't do that. You know, don't do that. Of course, the Jews have taken this to an extreme, and now it's very difficult in any Jewish meal. If you're flying an aircraft and you choose, you know, a kosher meal, you just won't get things like milk or real butter or things with your meal, because they've always had difficulty in saying, well, what if you got some meat, some lamb, or some beef, or whatever? And what happens if the milk or the butter that you've got in the same meal might have come from the cow's mother or the lamb's mother? You can't tell, can you? So it might be possible that that you would be eating the same meal, a piece of beef, and having butter on your roll, which came from the mother of the cow. And of course, when it's in your stomach, they'll be boiling together in your digestive juices. So they've taken this verse to an extreme, and now it's difficult to get butter and milk with any meal that you eat in the Jewish countries. Verse 20, "Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Beware of him and obey his voice, and do not provoke him, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him." This angel being, Jesus Christ in his pre-human form. "But if you indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I'll be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries." This sounds like a pretty good promise, to have this being on your side who's going to go before you and check out the path, the way, and see off your enemies. That's really a very good promise. And for you and I today, I think we know that we have a helper on our side, that Jesus Christ is our advocate, is our high priest, is our helper, and Jesus Christ is going before us to help us to find the way to his kingdom, and Jesus Christ is looking after us, and we should be able to sort of learn the lessons that these people didn't learn very well. "For my angel," verse 23, "will go before you and bring you into the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites and the Hivites and Jebusites, and I will cut them off. You shall not bow down to their gods nor serve them, nor do according to their works, but you shall utterly overthrow them and completely break down their sacred pillars. So you shall serve the Eternal your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from the midst of you. No one shall suffer miscarriage or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days." So lots of promises here if they would fall in line with the guidance and instructions and obey this particular being. Verse 27, "I will send my fear before you. I will cause confusion among all the people to whom you come, and I'll make all your enemies turn their backs to you." I mean, really, Israel didn't even have to worry about fighting. Why should they fight? God would fight for them. He's going to take care of all these enemies in his own rather clever way. Verse 28, "And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite from before you." When you send in some big hornets, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 inches long, and how big these ones would be, with big, powerful stingers, and send them into people in their homes, in the fields, start stinging people all over the place, and yep, you could empty a country in just a few days if you sent enough hornets in. People can't do much. Swatting, 8 billion hornets would be rather difficult. So God could easily drive out these people and allow Israel to move in and enjoy the prosperity of the land. Verse 29, "I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beast of the field become too numerous for you. Little by little I will drive them out from before you until you have increased and you inherit the land." It wouldn't be like a big bang scenario where the land's emptied in one weekend, and then come the Israelites, and by the time they get round to occupying the territory, there's wild animals by the hundreds of thousands, and there's weeds and things everywhere, and the fields are overgrown. And that wouldn't be very well organized. So God says, "I'll do it slowly. Little by little, I'll drive out the inhabitants, and then you can slowly occupy, have your families, grow up, move a bit further into the land, and over the course of a few generations, peacefully, quietly, and very effectively, you'll occupy all this territory." And Mr. Armstrong once explained this verse about, even our lives. We don't overcome all of our enemies instantaneously. We have obstacles in our life. We might want to overcome them in one weekend, but in reality, it's little by little. We overcome the enemy little by little, here a little and there a little. We grow through the years, hopefully getting stronger, hopefully getting more mature, hopefully able to overcome first one problem, then another weakness over here, and eventually, over the decades, we should be becoming much more expert. We should have occupied the land, so to speak, and put down many of our inherited weaknesses from our teenage years and so on. Verse 31, "And I will set you bounds from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, and from the desert to the river." That's a big territory, from the Nile, you know, right up to the Euphrates and so on. Lots of territory. "For I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them, nor with their gods." Why should you? I mean, this is the middle of the old covenant that God's giving. Here are the rules, the regulations. They haven't yet sealed it. This is a covenant that is, you know, so far superior to anything else that Israel could possibly even imagine. That why would they want to make a covenant with some other, you know, crazy god from the pagans? "They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you." Carrying on chapter 24. "Now he said to Moses, 'Come up to the Eternal, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. And Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people go up with him.' So Moses came and told the people all the words of the Eternal and all the judgments." So it was, in a sense, a reminder to the people, this is what the covenant contains. Here are all the words of the Eternal. That would be the words of Exodus 20, the Ten Commandments, which God would later inscribe on stone tablets, and separately all the judgments, the civil regulations. Those were the two aspects. "And all the people answered with one voice and said, 'All the words which the Eternal has said, we will do. Amen, brother Moses, go to it.'" So they thought, this is fantastic. I mean, these laws are nothing. And we become God's special treasure. Get all these blessings and benefits. He gives us his kingdom. He moves out our enemies. Wow, that's not bad at all. So they were all for it. It was, yes, I will, to this wedding ceremony. "And Moses wrote all the words of the Eternal, and he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. Then he sent young men of the children of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Eternal. And Moses took half the blood and put it in basins, and half the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant, which he'd written just a evening before, and read in the hearing of the people. And they said, 'All that the Eternal has said, we will do, and be obedient.'" It looks like they had no doubts. "And Moses took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, 'Behold, the blood of the covenant, which the Eternal has made with you, according to all these words.'" And that was the old covenant finally being sealed. The Ten Commandments were written down in the book. These regulations were written down in the book. People said, "All that you say to us, God, we will do. Not just what's here, but anything else you tell us. We're going to be a good wife to you. We're going to be submissive to you. Whatever you say, Jehovah God, goes. Amen, so be it." And so Moses wrote the terms of the covenant in a book called the Book of the Covenant, and sprinkle blood over it, which doesn't sound too good to me as a modern person, hygiene and all that sort of stuff, but in those days, I guess, blood wasn't as big an issue to them as it is to us, and sprinkle blood over the people. And that was probably quite an impressive ceremony to have been part of, and the people realized, yep, that covenant has been sealed with blood. And of course, for you and I today, we have a different covenant, a better covenant, based upon better promises, but it was still sealed with blood, blood of the new covenant. In this case, of course, in your case, in my case, it's the blood of Jesus Christ, not the blood of animals. Carrying on in verse 9, We'll go as far as the end of this chapter, and that will, I think, conclude us for today. Verse 9, then Moses went up, also Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. You might remember that Nadab and Abihu didn't stick around very much longer. I don't know whether perhaps this opportunity here went to their head, where they got a bit sort of pompous and arrogant about their perceived importance. But although we won't turn there for time reasons, if you wanted to look at Leviticus chapter 10 at some stage, you'll find that Nadab and Abihu, who were Aaron's two older sons, did on one occasion go to the tabernacle with the wrong type of fire. And God fried them on the spot. Because you don't treat God and his rules lightly. I'm afraid we do a little bit. I think sometimes we're a bit casual with God and his laws and commandments, and we know that God's very forgiving and very merciful, and that's fantastic, but we shouldn't become laissez-faire and casual about God or his rules. These guys did, Nadab and Abihu, and they paid an immediate penalty for that. But carrying on, so these guys went up the mountain, and they saw the God of Israel, and there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, and it was like the very heavens in its clarity. So I guess it's a pale blue crystalline color, like a pavement under the feet of this being. And how clearly they could see him, I don't know. I suspect not exactly with crystal clarity. It may be that God was sort of a partially hidden by, you know, mist and a smoke and a fire and so on, but they must have seen the appearance in there, some sort of shape and form of God, which is remarkable. Verse 11, but the nobles of the children of Israel, he did not, but on the nobles of the children of Israel, he did not lay his hand. So they saw God, and they ate and drank. Marvelous experience. Of course, most of them probably thought God was about to kill them, because they never did quite lose that that impression that God was out to destroy them in the wilderness, to starve them to death, to kill them with a lack of water, and to kill them by their enemies. And probably even here they thought, this is it. We're going up the mountain, he's going to kill us up there. But the point is made that he didn't. Verse 12, then the Eternal said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and be there, and I will give you tablets of stone, and the law and commandments which I have written, that you may teach them. So Moses arose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up to the mountain of God, Mount Sinai. And he said to the elders, wait here for us until we come back to you. Indeed, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man has a difficulty, let him go to them. And one imagines that Moses, when he left to go up the mountain this time, has been up several times altogether, probably thought, well, it's fair enough. Aaron is there, my older brother, a wise high priest and so on. And Hur has been around for a while. He's wise and sensible. So they can look after the people and keep things safe and sound. As we find out in a few chapters, it didn't work. But Moses wasn't to know that at this stage. So he thought, I'm okay, leaving two quite sensible guys behind to keep the shop. Then Moses went up into the mountain, and a cloud covered the mountain. Now the glory of the Eternal rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. One imagines that would be the seventh day Sabbath. The sight of the glory of the Eternal was like a consuming fire on the top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel. So just like, you know, a volcano, smoke, thunderings, fire burning, really very, probably quite frightening to be fair. And Moses went into the midst of the cloud and went up into the mountain. And Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. As we find in another verse, and during that time he did not eat or drink. 40 days fasting. Sounds like rather a long time, but no doubt, being in God's presence, there was a special power of some sort that kept Moses functioning very happily and healthily. And of course, 40 days, quite an interesting period in history. Moses fasted for 40 days, I think at least twice more. We know that Jesus fasted for 40 days and nights before he was in his battle with Satan. We know that Elijah once went 40 days and 40 nights on just some special food as he made his way down here to Mount Sinai to meet up with God. And of course, Israel was punished for 40 years. They spied out the land for 40 days. So number 40 certainly appears a number of times. Now we won't carry on, I think, any more, other than to say that from chapter 25, which we'll begin next time, we get to the details of the construction of the tabernacle. This was this special sanctuary that Moses was given the details of and given an insight how it looked, and he was then told how to build and erect this sanctuary, this tabernacle where God would come to meet them. And we'll go through that next time and explain some of the significance of these various bits and pieces and what they mean. I suppose already we can guess that, well, a tabernacle where God would come to dwell with his people, and of course, where does God dwell today? Hopefully, you and I today, the people of God, are the temple in which God dwells by his Spirit today. And so that will leave us with the rest of the story, which we'll pick up next time on the details of the famous tabernacle in the wilderness. Well, okay.